Summer is almost here, and what better way to spend time on the beach or in the park than with your nose in a good book?
Alan Chews reviews books for us, mostly fiction, and he joins us here in our studios. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, Michelle.
And we're joined also by a relatively new voice in the literary world. Her name is Samantha Hunt. She's the author of the novel The Invention of Everything Else. Welcome, Samantha.
Thanks.
You know, I asked both of you to get busy reading and bring some books back to us that you would recommend for our listeners. And Alan, first, you have a wonderful coming-of-age tale. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's Jane Ann Phillips' novel, Lark and Termite. It's a West Virginia Faulknerian family novel. Coming of age, yes, in part about a mute, brain-damaged boy. He's the termite of the title, who will never grow up. And in this character of Termite, we get this wonderful musical interior monologue. I want to read a little for you.
Oh, please do.
Sudden morning air floats low to the ground amid the small houses like fragrant evaporating mist, a cool bath of dew and shadow and damp honeysuckle scent. Heat will climb down in wisps and drifts, losing itself in pieces until it falls in gathered folds, pressing and pressing to hold the river still. It's a book so rich. You come for the story and you stay for the music.
Mm-hmm, and it feels like July right here in the studio.
It's heating up already.
After listening to you read that. Well, Samantha, now you bring us a story from Jason Brown. It's actually a collection of stories with a wonderful title, Why the Devil Chose New England for His Works.
Right. And it's really just kind of a perfect summer read, I thought, because so many of the pieces have this wonderful feeling of being ghost stories in some way. Literary ghost stories, but ghost stories nonetheless. They're set in a deeply forested northern Maine. These pieces are all kind of haunted by, there's loggers, there's bodies lost through lake ice, there's teenage lust kind of gone absolutely wild, runaways, drunks, trains, shipwrecks, Mother Nature raging out of control. And something about that really just strikes me as the perfect spookiness for what I want in a summertime read.
Samantha, you have another book for us from Eula Biss. It's called No Man's Land, American Essays, are another collection of short stories.
It's a collection of essays, but it's funny that you should say short stories because this collection really surprised me in that I don't think I've ever encountered a work of nonfiction written so lyrically that it reads as a short story. I mean, she's an absolutely beautiful lyrical writer. An essay about telephone poles morphs into this lesson on the history of lynching. And, I mean, I realize that sounds awful, but let me just read you the end of this essay to let you know what I mean here. My grandfather was a lineman. He broke his back when a telephone pole fell. Smashed him onto the road, my father says. Now I tell my sister these poles, these wires, do not look the same to me. Nothing is innocent, my sister reminds me. But nothing, I would like to think, remains unrepentant. One summer, heavy rains fall in Nebraska, and some green telephone poles grow small, leafy branches. And so she's kind of pastiching this whole piece together, moving between histories of atrocities, hatred in America, with her own, spliced with her own history.
I love that you did come to us with a collection of short stories and a collection of essays, because even though time does slow down in the summer, many people are still busy, and you have this wonderful sense of accomplishment when you can pick up and read a short story start to finish, and there the book is waiting for you for your next visit, wherever
exactly.
You're going.
Great.
Alan, you've carried into us a wonderful new edition of a beloved older book.
Yes, it's A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway that was published posthumously in 1964, and Hemingway's grandson, Sean Hemingway, has now edited a restored edition of the book based on all the scholarship that Hemingway folks have done, pointing out where Hemingway's original emphases lay in some of these essays and restoring about 60 pages of manuscript that was left out of the original Scribner's edition in 64. Listen to this wonderful little passage that he writes about writing. The blue-backed notebooks, the two pencils, and the pencil sharpener. A pocket knife was too wasteful. The marble-topped tables, the smell of café crème, the smell of early morning, sweeping out and mopping, and luck were all you needed. For luck, you carried a horse chestnut and a rabbit's foot in your right pocket. The claws scratched in the lining of pocket, and you knew your luck was still there. This is just wonderful writer's luck and reader's luck, too, that we now have this material restored to his original version.
This book has been loved by generations, especially people who take off for Paris and want to experience what Hemingway described as being very poor but also very happy. This was clearly a point in his life where he was carefree and feeling good about things. We have a wonderful collection of recommendations here. I hope that the two of you won't mind if I make a recommendation of my own, or at least share a book that I've read recently that I really have enjoyed, and I think others might also if they pick it up over the summer. It's a book called Serena.
Uh-huh.
By Ron Rash, and it was a book that just grabbed me. And I picked up the book, and I read the first paragraph, and boy, it had me. And if you don't mind, I'll just read quickly from it. When Pemberton returned to the North Carolina mountains after 3 months in Boston, settling his father's estate, among those waiting on the train platform was a young woman, pregnant with Pemberton's child. She was accompanied by her father, who carried beneath her shabby frock coat a bowie knife, sharpened with great attentiveness, and with great attentiveness, earlier that morning so it would plunge as deep as possible into Pemberton's heart. And that, bad things happened from that point forward.
That's a way to get the reader.
Yeah, they had a great economy.
To get the reader's heart beating.
Yeah, and the person, the knife actually goes in a surprising direction, and from there the story sort of hurtles forward, and I couldn't stop when I started reading the book. So that's my summer recommendation.
Best kind of book.
Sounds great.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming in and adding to our summer to-do list with many good books, all good recommendations. And just to recap of what we've heard from Alan Chuse, his summer reading suggestions are as follows: Lark and Termite by Jane Ann Phillips, A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway, and from Samantha Hunt, Jason Brown's story collection called Why the Devil Chose New England for His Works, and from Eula Biss, Notes from No Man's Land, American Essays. And finally, my pick, Serena, a novel, and that's by Ron Rash. Thanks to both of you. Thanks so much, Alan. Thanks to Samantha.
A pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Chuse teaches writing at George Mason University. His new book, A Trance After Breakfast, will be published next week, and Samantha Hunt is the author of The Invention of Everything Else. We've been talking about books for summer reading. For a complete list and for more ideas for reading, you can go to our website. That's npr.org/books.
The wedding announcements of the Sunday New York Times document much more than just nuptials. As our own David Brooks pointed out some years ago in his book Bobos in Paradise, on those pages you can almost feel the force of the mingling SAT scores. It's Dartmouth marries Berkeley, MBA weds PhD. Brooks saw patterns of status in those New York Times announcements with their catalog of academic degrees and parents' professions. Rob Bedecker and his fellow members of the Casper Hauser Comedy Group have found enough material for a very funny little book.
Carolyn Hansen and Dean Van Wyck. Carolyn Hansen was married to Dean Van Wyck on Saturday at the Peachtree Farm in Scarsdale, New York. The groom, 38, wore tight-fitting purple breeches, a white silk shirt, a fox fur mantle, and a livery collar from which was suspended a diamond the size of a walnut. Mr. Van Wyck's padded codpiece was stuffed with jewels and weapons. He carried a staff made of silver and bedecked with topaz. The bride, 33, wore a strapless white Vera Wang wedding gown.
That's a reading from Weddings of the Times, a parody, that's the name of the book, and Rob Bedecker joins us now from San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you, Robert.
What inspired Weddings of the Times?
Well, I think there are a lot of inspirations. You know, the wedding announcements in the Times are so perfect and polished, and I think the inspiration comes from that sort of primal feeling one gets when one sees a perfect picture, which is to sort of scribble a mustache on it or draw some sunglasses on it. Like you did when you were a kid. But we found something interesting is what's not said. And one of the pleasures of reading the Times announcements is sort of wondering what's left out or what's going on behind the scenes.
Jane Resnick and Paul Merrill. Jane Resnick and Paul Merrill were married yesterday at the Los Palos Community Center. Ms. Resnick, 28, is the founder and proprietor of the Bead and Seed Store in Ukiah, California. The store operates using a unique model of community commerce, whereby shoppers can milk goats or provide childcare in exchange for beads or seeds. The bride's parents are Dr. and Mrs. John Resnick of Long Island. Dr. Resnick is chief of neurosurgery at Massachusetts General Hospital. The bridegroom, 39, is also a doctor, Dr. Stupid, a noted medical marijuana advocate who passes out joints from a unicycle.
It should be noted that Stupid is spelled with S-T-O-O-P-I-D.
O-O-P-I-D. And all of these, of course, come with a photograph to depict the couple in that perfect eyes at the same level pose that the New York
Very
Times
important to line the eyebrows up.
One of your wedding announcements in the book is bathroom woman, comma, bathroom man.
That's right. We felt like that was a couple that needed to be connected. So we have finally the wedding announcement from the silhouette icon on each of those doors.
To tell us which bathroom to go into. Why don't you read that announcement for us?
Sure. The man and the woman from the bathroom door married each other on Saturday at Telco Park. For the ceremony, the bride and groom chose a clean, modern look. The groom wore a pearl-colored Nehru tuxedo with matching cashmere stump covers. The bride wore a necklace ivory A-line dress that accentuated her chewable vitamin C-shaped head and fun-dip legs. For their honeymoon, the couple is planning to mail themselves to Belize.
Very good. What David Brooks remarked on some years ago in the Times notices was the similarity of the people who get married and the sort of academic and professional inbreeding of the Times wedding announcements. But you have one, Heather Wilson, Darren Stegan, which I think is my favorite for the wildly different couple that get married.
Heather Wilson, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Mark Wilson of New Haven, was married yesterday to Darren Stegan, son of Mr. and Mrs. Toby Stegan of Wahasset, New York. The bride, 28, is the former national women's tennis champion and currently works as a Broadway actress and fashion model for Armani. She deferred enrollment at Yale University in order to serve as a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader from 1997 to 2001. The bridegroom, 38, resides with his parents in Wahasset. He is a part-time student at Ichabod Community College, where he studies the Internet. The elaborate ceremony took place in Mr. Stegan's mind.
This is the wedding announcement he would like to see in the New York Times.
That's right. The book allowed us to pair a lot of people together that you might not see in the real paper and to be a little more inclusive. You know, we have zombies and chihuahuas.
On page 54, there's a good couple, Bernice Bannister and Stephen Shipley.
Bernice Eleanor Bannister and Stephen Lee Shipley were married on Saturday by the Reverend Pace Newfeld at the Hopsbury Farm near Nashua, New Hampshire. The bride, 35, runs a rabbit rescue and rehabilitation center in Nashua. The groom, 38, is a doctoral candidate in geology at the University of New Hampshire. He is also a part-time falconer. In separate attempts to surprise one another, both Ms. Bannister and Mr. Shipley release groups of their respective hobby animals in a nearby pasture. She, a warren of Dutch lops. He, a cauldron of peregrine falcons. And I'll leave the rest to the imagination.
You'd have to say that no animals were harmed in the writing of this, in the writing of this book.
That's right.
Well, Rob Bedecker of the Caspar Hauser Comedy Group and of the group that has written the book Weddings of the Times, thanks a lot for talking with us. And we'll listen to one more of your announcements as we've produced it here.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
The best gifts come in small packages. For Phyllis and Jim Cantrell, the small packages took the form of miniature horses. The groom, 32, who founded the mini horse aid organization known as Painted Promise, met Ms. Baumgarten at a mini donkey roundup for singles. "Everyone in this community knows Phyllis," he said. "Something about small horses brings out a big heart in this girl." The bride, 30, who maintains the website lilhorsehelper.com, was wooed by the groom's commitment to these animals. "He's really been an innovator in the world of tiny equine charity," she said. "In 2007 alone, he raised $240. For animals this small, that's a huge amount of money. Remember that even a big mini horse can be smaller than a human hair." "Sometimes I do wonder if we're talking about the same kind of mini horse," said the groom.
I'm thinking of the ones that are about the size of a Great Dane.
And speaking of weddings, we're collecting stories about the least appropriate song that you've heard at a wedding. Tell us about the wedding song that fell flat by going to nprmusic.org.
A man named David Kaczynski lives in upstate New York, where he's executive director of New Yorkers for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. You may already be wondering, is he any relation to... Well, yes. David Kaczynski is the younger brother of Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber, who's now in prison for running what amounts to a terrorist-by-mail campaign. From 1978 to 1995, Theodore Kaczynski mailed 16 bombs that killed 3 people and injured 23. He was identified and arrested largely because his brother David had begun to suspect that he was the Unabomber and contacted authorities. David Kaczynski has now written about his relationship with the brother he grew up with and admired. It appears in a new collection called Brothers, 26 Stories of Love and Rivalry. David Kaczynski joins us from member station WAMC in Albany, New York. Mr. Kaczynski, thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, thanks for having me on.
I'm going to ask the same question to begin with that I promised to end with. Do you love your brother?
I do. I've always loved Ted. It's something I've never doubted, even though my faith in him has been shaken.
Now, there's 7 years age difference between you. Reading through the account of your childhood together, he was considered to have a special cast of mind, and yet, you know, he didn't torture animals. He didn't spew hate.
Certainly he didn't fit the profile of an antisocial person. As you said, he loved animals. He didn't torture animals. I remember approaching our mother at one point and, you know, asking, "Mom, what's wrong with Ted? Why doesn't he have friends?" And, "Mom, I think, you know, really is a kind of healthy thing for a parent to say when they get a question like this," said, "you know, people are different. You know, your brother likes to read. He likes to work on things. He likes to be by himself. That's fine. You're social. You like people. People like you. That's fine, too. Everybody doesn't have to be the same." But when I pressed her a little farther, she talked to me about an experience Ted had had as a tiny infant. At 9 months, he had to be hospitalized for a rash that had covered his body. Mom told me at that point that she believes Ted had been traumatized by that early experience, that as a little baby they couldn't explain to him what was going on, that this was all for his own benefit, and that he had somehow felt deeply, deeply abandoned. And at that point, Mom actually said, "David, don't ever abandon your brother, because that's what he fears the most." And I always remembered that story as, you know, as Ted behaved a little bit strangely, or he didn't seem trusting of people. I thought, well, gee, it's that experience that continues to haunt him.
Can I get you to tell the story about when the two of you went camping in where you were in Nebraska, looking up at the stars?
Yeah, there were a couple of summers I'd spent with Ted, and in the mid to late 60s, Ted had said that he was quitting his job as a professor. And I remember as we were driving back home, it was probably late August, and at that point I'd had enough of camping. I was ready to get back to my life, back to college, back to my girlfriend, back to home, and regular baths and meals. And I remember we were camped out in a county park in Nebraska, and it was kind of a wonderful, wonderful evening. There was like a strong breeze, but it was a very warm breeze, and we were lying side by side in this field with the grass stirring and the breeze, looking up at this immense, clear, starry sky. And I remember saying to Ted, "Gee, I wish we were home." And Ted said, "I really wish we didn't have to go back." Mm. It was a defining difference. You know, I was connected to other people, and Ted, I think, felt most comfortable when he was by himself or with his little brother, who I was the only person he'd ever loved. It's ironic now, because I'd give anything to have that moment back and see Ted again and share some of that intimacy and innocence.
You don't hear from him at all?
You know, Mom writes to him every week. Mom's 92 years old now, not in the best of health, but very clear in her mind, and nothing would mean more to her than if Ted were to respond. I write him less frequently, birthday, Christmas, if something's going on with Mom's health, and to date he has never responded. He told his lawyers when he had lawyers that he wanted nothing to do with his family. As I see it, as Mom sees it, he's really in two prisons. One is the maximum security prison where he'll spend the rest of his life. The other is this prison of mental illness.
So I have to ask at the end, your brother killed innocent people, not by mistake or even in a moment of rage, but deliberately applied his widely heralded brilliance to figuring out crude ways to kill people. Do you love him?
I absolutely reject what he did. I know that if he had not been ill, he wouldn't have done these things. I also believe that within my brother there's a core of sanity and goodness. I saw too much evidence of it as I was growing up to believe that it could simply disappear. Ted was brilliant. In certain respects, he had high levels of skills. Many people with mental illness are very, very bright. But Ted was delusional. He was living in a world that was disconnected from other people, disconnected from his own core self, I believe. I love Ted. I don't know if he understands that. And, you know, a brother... It's interesting to me in reading this book and many stories, a wide range of stories about brother relationships. And of course, we all experience that differently. But I did sense a common thread that your brother, in some sense, is a fellow traveler in your life's journey. And you're taking this journey through the universe. And to me, that sense of connection during my formative years makes it impossible to ever disown my brother.
Mr. Kaczynski, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
David Kaczynski. He writes about his older brother, Ted Kaczynski, in a new collection, Brothers, 26 Stories of Love and Ravelry. And you can find an excerpt of David Kaczynski's essay from the collection, Brothers, at our website, npr.org.
Illicit Romance is the theme of the debut novel by William Coles. Prelude won rave reviews when it was released in Great Britain. For our three-book series, authors pick three books on one theme, and for us, Coles sticks with Illicit Romance, with this warning. All the books end badly, but that's part of the fun.
In all the love stories ever told, has there ever been such a recipe for disaster as in the tale of illicit love? Beginning 3,000 years ago, when Zeus, the married king of the gods, was gallivanting with all his many mistresses, the message was clear. Unconventional trysts are destined to end badly for all concerned. But how brightly these love affairs burn during their short span. Heroes become spies as they plot their next assignation, and brief encounters take on this huge intensity, where every moment is lapped up in haste and savoured for eternity. Perhaps the most eternal of forbidden love affairs is the 900-year-old story of a French philosopher and his beautiful young pupil. In Heloise and Abelard, we relive the fire of their brief affair and the longing that simmers for decades afterwards. This is not a happily ever after story. Heloise's jealous uncle puts an end to things and castration, a monastery and a nunnery follow. But still, the couple's passion for each other never subsides. While I am denied your presence, writes Heloise in one letter to her beloved Abelard, give me at least through your words some sweet semblance of yourself. Ah, tortured longing, the hallmark of illicit love. The Well of Loneliness, Radcliffe Hall's pioneering tale of lesbian love, overflows with it. Banned in Britain in 1928, the book went on to become a global bestseller. Based on Hall's own life, it contains much anguished hand-wringing as the heroine Stephen dithers over whether to take a bite from this forbidden fruit. 8 years on, it is hard to understand how the uptight Brits could have branded this novel an obscenity. The very raunchiest line in the book is, "That night, they were not divided."
But even if the prose seems a bit tame to the modern reader, Hall's novel is still a rollicking read, and you can tell right from the start that this love affair is heading for the rocks. 40 years after The Well of Loneliness shocked Britain, Philip Roth unleashed Portnoy, the man who put the id into yid. Portnoy's Complaint is a crazy romp through the protagonist's extraordinary love life as he attempts to derail his tyrannical mother. I cannot think of another book which is so hilarious in its descriptions of lovemaking, or quite so shocking. Featuring a wealth of illicit love, the one thing that Roth's sex scenes have in common is that they are all utterly cringe-making. It doesn't seem to matter what sort of sexual mischief Portnoy has immersed himself into. Always in the background, there is the sound of his mother hammering on the door and demanding to be let in. Even decades after I'd first read the book, Roth's toe-curling descriptions of love in the bathroom are still seared into my memory. And how does it all end for Portnoy? It ends badly, just as these tales always do. But that, though, is the very nature of illicit love, and why we can't get enough of it.
That's William Coles, author of a novel that's also about illicit love. It's called Prelude. He was recommending Eloise and Abelard, a new biography by James Burge, The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe Hall, and Portnoy's Complaint by Philip Roth. For more stories of love, illicit and otherwise, you can visit the summer book section of npr.org.